Hey everyone, welcome to the Knowledge Exchange podcast. I'm your host, Daniel Arbilla, lead mentor at the Knowledge Exchange, where we specialize in helping clinicians apply a biopsychosocial approach to their practice. For those around Coffs Harbour, we'll be traveling up next month on the 25th to 26th of May. So if interested, check out our website, tkex.org, for all the details. Today, I'm excited to be joined by Diego Hidalgo. Diego's a new grad physio based in Spain and the human behind the Skeptical Physio, a crowd favorite on Instagram, one of my favorites as well. And we're going to dive into his story, philosophy, critical thinking, some takeaways from his recent paper I'm really excited about, and more. So Diego, without further ado, I really appreciate you being here.
Thank you so much, Dali. It's a pleasure to be here with you today.
So for those who may be following you, and if not, I highly recommend everyone following the Skeptical Physio. But for us who don't maybe know the human behind the face, behind the Sisyphus logo, what's your story?
My name is Diego Hidalgo. I'm a physical therapist from Spain. I'm 27 at the moment. And I was born in Madrid. I was raised in the south, but I came back when I was 16 or so to finish my studies and start college. I started, before being a physio, I started college as a journalist student. I finished that and I worked as a journalist for 1 year, more or less. After that, I realized that I was not cut for that. So I chose to make a big change in my life, a changing careers and leaving the social sciences and start going with health sciences and specifically with physical therapy. After that, when I was in my second year as a student, I was very frustrated with the state of things. So I believe that it was a good idea for my mental health to create a social media account, which may sound counterproductive because social media seems to be the start of all evils, the Pandora box nowadays. But it has helped me a lot because I found a place to share my ideas without being judged, or at least being judged with in a less harsh way that I was being judged in reality, in real life, by my lecturers or by some of my classmates, by some of my clinical instructors. And each year I think that the sentiment is growing within me that I made a good decision 4 years ago, and each year it's becoming something better. And even this year, that has kind of materialized in the publication of my first article, The Fallacy of Anatomical Possibilism, with Oliver Thompson and Andrew McMillan, which is making a lot of noise for the good and for the bad.
That's exciting. That's amazing. So quite a journey from, did you say that you started the account during your second year physio school? Yep. And yes, you had some maybe unproductive debates or discussions with
many
kind of colleagues,
I have, I imagine. Many.
And so the initial reason was to kind of share some of the knowledge, some of the papers, some of the research, like dissect it and disseminate it. And you felt actually kind of opposite experience of a lot of people were like less judged online than you were.
Much less judged. And if you think about that, it's a bit crazy because now I have like more than 20,000. I'm like 20,800 followers or something like that. And I'm being judged in a much less harsh way than when I was in a class with 30 persons. So if you think about that, I'm having some debates, but I will classify them as civil discussions. We respect each other even if we disagree, and I don't have any problem with that. Like, I don't have problems with that kind of debates. I have problems with people judging me by things that don't have anything to do with the quality of my ideas, the ad hominems and all those reasonings that don't go anywhere because they don't add nothing to the debate. They just add noise, and that noise what makes is an uncomfortable situation that is kind of opposite to anything good.
Yeah, it's just kind of takes away from the points or the claims or the content that you are trying to share. Kind of the focus is on the person or the kind of straw man of a lot of their arguments. So I'm wondering, with the journalism, and I can still hear you, as long as I can hear you, I can
yes, I'm here.
Perfect. The kind of technical malfunctions from across the other, from one side of the globe to the other. There you go. You're back. So wondering with the journalism, and I imagine there might be some things that you could see within social media, but what did you kind of learn, or what have you used from journalism into kind of the way that you disseminate, promote some of the things that you do on social media?
The thing with journalism is that I believe it attracts a certain kind of people, the same for any other degree. Like it's totally normal. But I don't want to say that I didn't learn anything from journalism, but I was expecting a very different thing, much more communication intensive. However, during those years, I did the same as with physical therapy, and I thought, okay, I need to learn certain abilities, and I'm going to do it in any way I can achieve it. So things that I have been able to translate to physical therapy, whether it's in the social media account or whether it's on my clinical practice, the importance of nonverbal language, also the importance of verbal language, because both things go hand in hand. The requirement to read a lot, because I wanted to be, because journalism can take many shapes and forms, but I wanted to be a writer as a journalist. So I thought, okay, if I want to write things that are easy to be read by people in different circumstances, I need to read a lot, be able to make things as simple as I can. And there's a debate within journalism of if we should do that or if we should do the opposite and try to raise the bar. But I'm of the opinion that what I want is I try to apply to the to not to the general population, but to everyone, in that sense that if you read my ideas, you can understand a lot of them, if even if you lack some context. I don't want to fall into technicisms or technical terms, because usually they don't add anything or much for most of the people, and the two or three that may want those terms are also fine with, okay, you are not using this word, but you are explaining it in your own words. So that was really important. I would like to invest more time into these kind of things of audio and other form of media, because as a journalist, you learn also for sources or all forms of media. But I'm still living of my writer spirit.
Yeah, super interesting. The importance of language, as you mentioned, nonverbal and verbal, and the way that we can communicate ideas in a way that's accessible and not so jargony. I think there is, I had a chat with Jordan Feigenbaum of Barber Medicine, and there's like a spectrum where if it's kind of oversimplified, it can become false. So I think that there is that kind of risk where there's a loss of some nuance, but I'm totally on your side of just making it accessible. Otherwise, it's just behind kind of academia or the kind of buzzwords that only, a select few academics or researchers or educators know, and it's not reaching the people that it needs to reach.
Yeah, absolutely. And the other day I published a post that was talking about this in some ways, because I talk about cults in physical therapy, in nutrition, and in the fitness space. And there was a comment that said, okay, they may be using a language that is really incorrect, but they are reaching the people. And I thought, okay, you have a point. So I remember what Feigenbaum said. I think that it was Einstein who said, like, you need to make things simpler, but not too simple, or to make the statements correct. But at the same point, I'm totally fine with saying things that are incorrect, a bit incorrect, if in exchange I can make it much more accessible to everyone. But yeah, I follow that line too. I try to make things, all the things that I say, I try to be as correct as my current understanding thing. Like, if you see my post, from time to time I re-upload old posts, but I always change something, because I look back and I say, okay, the Diego that wrote this 2 years ago is not the same as today, and I'm not comfortable with sharing that post anymore. I need to change it.
Yeah, that constant kind of updating of our ideas, I think, shows that we grow, and we also can maybe find different ways to communicate the idea so it can reach more people in a easier to understand, to digest, to then interpret way, rather than kind of
Absolutely,
jargon.
And I believe that it's something good when you cringe at the things that you said like 2 or 3 or 5 years ago, because that means that you are evolving, and we shouldn't run away from that, because that's part of our evolution. I believe that we are quite influenced by how politicians kind of act. Like, it seems they never change their opinion, and because they are the ones who are representing the public, we may try to become a reflection of them, like a mirror. But that's the worst that we can do, because politicians are not logical. They always are pursuing most of the time, they are pursuing emotions to move people, because they know that emotions move people much more than logical statements, which is true. I'm not against that. I'm just saying that many times they fall into many fallacies.
Yeah, the emotional rhetoric. And I think with that, in general, it's easier to convey a message to people's emotion and appeal to that, rather than kind of mm-hmm. go into maybe more factual ideas. Because
Absolutely.
If you are going with evidence, then you are going to change your opinion
yes.
over time, because science.
I remember reading about that as a journalism student. We call it the cascades, or the what? I think that cascades of information, is that term correct? I've used cascade, but it's like waterfalls. Yes. So what we saw is that lies are able to be spread much more easily and quickly than the truths. And for example, all this job that fact checkers are doing to correct those statements is. It has a point, but it's kind of pointless, because people see that as, okay, they are trying to silence us. They are trying to shut down this truth. So it kind of reinforces that tribe mentality. So it's a very complex thing, and I don't know how we can change that, but it's so sad.
Yeah, there's a lie can travel kind of halfway around the world while the truth is putting on its
mm-hmm.
shoes. Some
yes.
people say it's Mark Twain, but then I found out that it wasn't. So I'm not going to say who it was, because I actually don't know who coined that term. But yeah, the cascades of information. I think that has a lot of kind of relevance to people who are kind of disseminating information, to at least know that that kind of thing exists and there are these frameworks, and how our message can be interpreted in different ways. So yeah, it's a hard job doing what you're doing.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to pivot into philosophy and to critical thinking. And
okay.
I've really valued the way that you can communicate the importance
mm-hmm.
of these concepts. And I find it can be challenging initially, because philosophy is fucking really hard to grasp, especially kind of the original texts.
Mm-hmm.
So what would you say then, and start with whichever one, I see them as overlapping. What would you say
mm-hmm.
is the importance, the relevance,
mm-hmm.
the usefulness of critical thinking, of philosophy for clinicians?
I think that both things are really important, but they come with a price. For example, as a student, when I started to kind of ask questions, I realized that reaching or pursuing the quote-unquote truth is usually going to cause you a lot of issues with other people, because of course it makes a lot of sense. You are in a class, you're with a lecturer that is a PhD and he has been doing this for 30 years and he has a lot of accolades, milestones in his career. And suddenly a second year student raises his hand and said, okay, but don't you think that you are wrong because X, Y, and Z? That's in some ways, because philosophy works in that way. We are always using philosophy, but that philosophy is transferred to us due to culture, the, our experiences, and we are adopting some frameworks that allow us to exist and to coexist with others in this world. But the thing is that we are not aware of them. We ignore them because we don't deep dive into our own ways to define reality. And that costs, again, a price because we believe that that's the normal state of things when usually if we try to compare these frameworks, for example, if you ask me compared to if you ask a middle-aged man from California, our frameworks will differ in topics really interesting to like free will, freedom, the value of life, the importance of education or healthcare. So that's really important, but it comes with a price, and that price, sometimes I'm asked by a student, hey, do you think that I should raise my hand in class and ask this question? I say, if I could go back, I couldn't do it because I didn't win anything from that. And it kind of muddied the waters. And I think that it was 2 years ago, a student said, look, I'm sharing your post, and I'm followed by some of my lecturers and my classmates. And I believe that some of them are starting to think that I'm not an outsider, but a contrarian. And I'm kind of developing a fear to share your post, not because of the quality of your post, but because of what others will say. And that thing that the good mentality, but yeah, what others will say. I'm going to look to the other side or something like that. We have seen how that has taken some gruesome shapes during, for example, the Great Wars. So yeah, it's kind of interesting. And another point, as you said, is that philosophers usually have a really introverted way to say things. They say things they are too hermetic. Well, their writings are too hard to taste because they are really, the same thing happens for scientists. If we could compare the difficulty of the readings of scientists and philosophers, we will realize that most of the people cannot grasp those concepts many times because what they are saying, but how they are saying things. And that was one of the things that I wanted to try with the manuscript, that is in some ways philosophy, but in some ways also science. I'm going to try to explain this in an easier way. It's not academically as correct as we could, but I believe that if we want to reach as many people as possible, we need to make this a small sacrifice.
Yeah, super interesting. And by the manuscript, that's your recent paper with anatomical possibilism. Is that?
Mm-hmm.
Yep. So we'll be diving into that. I'll hold that thought.
Okay.
I'm very interested in what you mentioned about that contrarian piece. It's like,
mm-hmm,
if we are sharing or promoting an idea that questions an underlying belief or a theory, a value, an assumption, it can feel like you are being opposite, or it can feel like an attack or like a direct challenge. So I can see that there is that risk of offending, of the other person misinterpreting the message. So that it's very difficult to kind of communicate in a way that allows discourse of multiple ideas, multiple perspectives. Mm-hmm. It's so easy to go like the us versus them route. One, if you could add on that, what are your thoughts?
Yes. The thing is that if we need to shift perspectives for a while, because for the tribe or for the group that we are trying to criticize, we are the contrarian. We are always the contrarian. So even if we are making skeptical statements and we are like kind of creating logical premises that may lead to a better outcome or a better knowledge, we will always be contrarian, or most of the time will be contrarian for the other group, because the other group has some intellectual and usually also economic conflicts of interest that are leading them to believe that what they're promoting is the good thing. And that happens with ideas, but also with a business, with an initiative, a project, a paper, a new source of income or of knowledge. So we will always be contrarian for them. What I have tried to make this kind of experiment, social experiment, is if I can be nice to them and say, okay, I understand where you're coming from. You are trying to say this. I don't try to strawman the arguments of my opposition. And I try to make it clear, like, I'm not criticizing you. I'm sure that if we will be friends, if we met in real life, and we could drink a beer together, and there wouldn't be any problem with us. I'm just criticizing this idea, but you are much more than this idea. And I believe that sometimes most of the times we are too attached to certain ideas, because those ideas give us a reason, give us meaning. But as I believe that there are clear differences between being a contrarian and being a skeptical person. The first one is that contrarians usually are acting upon emotions. They are criticizing you because they don't like you as a person. They don't like your religion, your race, your beliefs, what you did some years ago. That's being a contrarian, because I'm not criticizing your idea, I'm criticizing you. And we can learn from everyone, including really bad people, because that doesn't mean that we are becoming that people. If a dictator loves animals, okay, I love animals too. And let's say that they have, for example, they believe that we should all be nice to certain people. Okay, I'm okay with being nice with a lot of people, so we kind of share part of the sentiment. Skeptical people don't care about the person behind the ideas. They care about the idea, or the ideas itself, the premises that you are trying to arch upon. So that's the first thing, that you are changing emotions versus or against logical premises. The second thing is that contrarians usually are doing or are saying things due to self-interest. While, for example, in the Mertonian laws, one of those laws is that the scientific enterprise should be done with its interest. You are trying to reach the truth, even if it makes you unhappy. Like, I'm okay with being unhappy if I'm closer to the true phenomenon. And that's also something that I'm thinking about Kuhn, Thomas Kuhn, and the paradigms and the scientific revolutions, the structure. How I said, like, okay, if you think about it that way, many scientists also are contrarian to the paradigm, even if they are PhDs, they have many years of research experience and all of that. They are kind of contrarians because they don't accept the paradigms. And I think that it was Max Planck who said that science advances one funeral at a time. So for some ideas to prosper, or some models of care, for example, decades need to pass, because some people need to, unfortunately, pass away, because they will never embrace the new thing. Maybe because they are too old, or because they can't accept that they were wrong, or because they don't care. That goes against their source of income, for example. I'm going to say something, but I'm not going to say any names, but there was a degree that recently, that's an information that I have received, change their structure, and certain subjects kind of passed away. But there was an opposition from the lecturers of those subjects. And I thought, okay, if those subjects kind of die, we will realize, or that people may lose their job. So they don't want to, even if it's more appropriate to eliminate those subjects, that people will never accept that there's a need to delete these subjects. because that will leave them jobless.
Yeah, wow, there's so much there with the I think you touched on the theme of if we attach ourselves, our identity, our meaning, our purpose, our kind of job, career, everything that's of importance to an idea or to a belief, it can be very difficult to even open up different possibilities. It can be difficult to examine critically, honestly, with humility, what we believe or what we hold on to. And that's the kind of value of critical thinking, of having that ability to step back, to zoom out, to understand the ideas, to focus on the content, the ideas, because it can be so easy to have that emotion. And that's where the contrarian would be different, in that it's almost intentionally disagreeing for the purpose of controversy, for the purpose of kind of opposition, rather than genuinely trying to find the truth or genuinely trying to arrive at a collaborative discussion.
And they will disagree no matter what. And many times we are seeing it on social media, like, okay, dude, like, we are not in my case, but sometimes these big influencers. I'm thinking, for example, to leave the field a bit. Lane Norton, he's always criticizing nutritionists and some of what he calls like bullshit. So many times he's doing a hell of a job because he's saying, okay, you are saying this based on these three studies, but these three studies were carried on mice. And mice differ a lot from humans. So we have a human randomized controlled trials. If you see his YouTube video, he's always making that kind of sound. And he'll say, we have five human randomized controlled trials. And we are seeing that this thing that you are criticizing, when we try it on humans, it doesn't make any difference. And in exchange for for that, this substance or this food is adding a lot of value, maybe because it doesn't have any calories, so it can help if you're trying to lose weight, or maybe because it's easy to be digested for some people. Let's say that you are lactose intolerant, for example. So that people, they sometimes they listen to those refutations, and they say, no, that's a lie because those studies were paid by big pharma or by the big food enterprises or something like that. And it's like, okay, I'm sure that if I could show you that those studies were carried by independent researchers, you will find you could move the goalposts. You will find another reason why that isn't true, and we could be like that until the end of times because you will always change the goalposts. So I can never score.
Yeah, and I think just awareness of the I forgot the name of the fallacy, but moving the goalposts, I think it is. Just awareness of that, I think, is like a tool that we can take out and use. It's like we've got a new set of glasses, and we can see clearer. Oh, they're just moving the goalpost, and they're using a technique. Maybe they're not even aware of it. Hey, I noticed that we were talking at this point, and you made this point. Did you notice that you changed the subject? And if so, you know, that's like a more productive discussion. Whereas if you're not aware, you don't know what you don't know. You don't know that that's just like a rhetorical technique or a fallacy.
Yes, and you need to choose your battle carefully because sometimes it has happened to me that I'm trying to convince someone and I'm trying to make really good arguments, but they say they are always moving the goalposts, and after a while you realize, okay, I've spent 2 hours of my life trying to pursue something that will never happen because this person is not adding anything. Many times they are insulting you in some way, saying that you are an ignorant or you are dumb or you shouldn't know because it's Wednesday. And nowadays, I'm thinking, okay, those 2 hours of my life, I could have done many things. I could go to the gym, or read some papers, or listen to a podcast, or spend time with my family, or train in some martial arts or something like that. Like things that bring me joy to my life. So sometimes you need to be able to ask yourself, okay, am I going to spend time with this person that doesn't seem to be open to a civil discussion?
Yep, totally. The it's so easy to get lured into the kind of discussions that are clearly ending up in an unproductive, unhelpful way. So I think, yeah, stepping out of that, in particular social media comment sections, which we'll probably address later on. I could talk about this for hours. So I'm mindful of the time. I wanted to pivot to how you mentioned the importance of kind of seeking sources, seeking external sources, and how the community around you can influence us. And so I'm curious, how did you kind of know that you needed maybe to expand your social
Sure,
circle,
sure,
your
sure.
circle of influence?
So I started a Skeptical Physio, the account, as a student, and I realized that I wasn't getting from my social circle the things that I wanted as a physical therapist. Some people will say, the thing is, you don't need to change your circle. You just need to add new circles. I'm not telling people to stop talking with their classmates. That's not the thing, but because your classmates at the end of the day are beautiful people, and you're spending 4 or 3 or 7 years, depending on your country, with them. They are your friends and they are part of your life. You shouldn't move on from them. But if they are not giving you what you're expecting in terms of physical therapy or other things, it doesn't need to be physical therapy. You need to find external sources. In my case, I started trying with, I will say that I was a McGill fan. I'm not against him because I believe that he has produced very valuable research, but I was a fanboy. I was too edgy with him. Like, I was a contrarian, because if you didn't think like him, you're a contrarian. And I'm sure that there's a post on Reddit, I will find it, where I wrote a really cringy post on Reddit, like, okay, I found that McGill is the god of the spine. What who is the McGill of the shoulder or the neck or something like that? I will find. I'm sure that it's somewhere. You need to find circles. You need to find a community that gives you the things that you want. There are many communities, and there are communities in every language, I suppose. But in my case, I gave it a chance to the let's say the Spanish community, but I didn't get what I wanted at the time. So what I said is, okay, I'm going to write in English, because when I write in Spanish, people is telling me really nasty things, and I felt quite miserable during those times. So I started seeking for those circles, and nowadays, I have a lot of really good communities, and I interact with them, and it's a really fruitful relationship, including, for example, yes, your community, or the Level Up Initiative, or individual people like, for example, Alexis or Jacob, or I don't know, Ben Cormack, Adam Meekins. I'm talking with them, with many of them, on a daily basis, asking them questions. They are asking me questions. We are sharing papers. We are trying to refute each other. We are improving, because we are interacting with people that is on a similar, not on a similar level, but there's some kind of levels out there. But we are on a similar mission. We share a vision, and our vision is that we can improve the standard of care. And to do that, we need to question a lot of things that we were taught. And the things that we are learning maybe are wrong too. So we need to keep discussing and trying to shape the diamond.
Yeah, there is that opportunity with social media to open up and expand, and like you said, build, add new circles to our existing circles. I'm wondering if we reverse time, like I'm always curious. Some people have like an existential crisis, or they kind of there's like an aha moment of sorts. But for you, how did you know that you needed to go externally? Was it like a combination of different factors? Because I know there's probably it takes time. It takes a combination of different events and reflections and experiences. What was it like for you? How did you know that you needed to expand your circles?
Well, in my case, because who I am and my personality, I admit that I take too long to make decisions because my I try to kind of absorb as much information as I can before taking big decisions. And of course, there are many factors. I've talked about some of them, like my classmates and my lecturers being against, not against me, but against my ideas. But I remember I believe that there was a moment I was, at that time, I was reading a lot of papers, and I created a journal club for some of my friends. They were my classmates, but they are my friends nowadays. What I would do was I would send them a paper, maybe an editorial or whatever paper, and discuss it the next week. But I realized that no one was reading the papers. So what I said was, okay, I'm going to do it much more personalized. I'm going to talk with them. I'm going to ask them why they want to be a physical therapist. And I'm going to send them papers that are exactly about that. And I remember telling a friend who said, look, I tore my ACL as a student. As a student, I was 16 at the moment. I was playing basketball. And my dream is to take care of ACL athletes that are teenagers. And they want to become professionals, but they are seeing how their dreams are kind of fading away because of the injury. That's my dream. That's my vision. That's my mission. And I'm very emotionally attached to that thing. And I said, okay. And I sent him this paper. It was by Tool. And I think the year was 2017. It's like young athletes clear for sport participation before ACL reconstruction. And what they did was they tested and those athletes that were already playing, and they realized that there were really important strength deficits. Most of them didn't pass the basic return to sport criteria. And I sent him that to obtain a response because I said, okay, what I want you is to get angry because you can treat these people much better. Just you can raise the bar, you can raise the standard. So you will ask me, okay, Diego, what can I do to improve this standard of care? Because I don't want to be this person. But I asked him the next week, after 1 week of difference between me sending him this paper and me asking this question, I said, no, I haven't read it yet. So I asked him the next week. I said, no, I'm too busy. And he was playing like one of these games. It was Clash Royale or Clash of Clans while saying that. And I said, okay, I can't. I need to change everything. I need to get away from this and obtain these things from other people.
Yeah, that I can resonate so much with the kind of overly passionate sharing of resources that can be just interpreted as spam, or there is that lack of kind of interest, the value, the effort it takes to read. So yeah, I think finding people who are maybe share similar values and can appreciate the research and can help you grow, and maybe that is sometimes different to the colleagues, even lecturers, tutors that we have, and just recognizing that that's also they are human and they're probably amazing people. It's just separate. This is just about, hey, if you want to learn something, maybe go to the sources, go to people who are actively engaging in building knowledge. And that might be in many different places, many different contexts outside of university even.
Yes, and I admit that it's a bit sad to, because we all have expectations about what university should be, and our families educate us in a framework that teaches that university is the last bastion of knowledge. But it's sad that sometimes you need to leave those college university circles to find the good information.
Yeah, I think if I had heard this podcast maybe 5-6 years ago, I would have really appreciated. So hopefully this has resonated with some of the listeners. And moving on, speaking of kind of the research world, and you've dabbled into it now with your recent manuscript, if you could go over some of the takeaways, that's the paper, it's all connected, so it all matters, the fallacy of osteopathic anatomical possibilism, and highly recommend listeners to check out your posts that you've made on it. But just curious, some of the takeaways, and then like diving into the actual value, I guess, after you've destroyed anatomy with one paper, Diego?
No, anatomy, of course, has its place, but what I'm criticizing is not anatomy, because anatomy is kind of dead. Like, anatomy is a subject that is dead. Everything is kind of discovered. Even if we, of course, we will keep finding new small details within anatomy, but anatomy is kind of an established hard science. But it's the use that we are making out of it. That's problematic. And I talk about osteopathy because I believe that osteopathy represents the peak of this anatomical possibilism. But of course, it's not exclusive. It's a trait that is shared by physical therapists, by chiropractors, by, of course, exercise physiologists, surgeons, physicians. Like, I believe that this is a really important takeaway. We talk about it a bit in the paper, but anatomical possibilism is not exclusive. An exclusive invention of osteopath is a common trait shared among the whole MSK field.
Yeah, just the implausible kind of claims regarding anatomy. I think another buzzword is like the patho-anatomical explanations for pain and how you can just make shit up about earlobes and tongues and like meridians and links all across. Yes, and use very much that scientism or the anatomical terms, but then have ridiculous kind of causal claims.
Yeah, sometimes we exploit anatomy and the links that we can establish, this interregional dependence. And during that journey, we commit many leaps of faith that cause really, I don't want to say something that can be misinterpreted, but it kind of becomes really problematic from a scientific standpoint, because you are saying things that may sound like scientific, but they are not scientific at all, because they may sound plausible, but they may lack biological plausibility.
Yep. There's a podcast called Decoding the Gurus. They talk about galaxy brain or the idea of like scientism, where we can use fancy sounding like chemical, biochemical stuff. Like, it's big in the hacking kind of biohacking industry.
Yes.
And that's so prominent in a lot of kind of corrective exercise narratives, explanations, and it can pass through a filter that makes it seem very smart. It makes it sound legitimate. But then diving into the like a paper like yours, you can start realizing, oh, that these are overly extrapolated. This has no actual biological plausibility, even though it may sound to even the layperson, I'm thinking, like a patient, a client, it may sound amazing.
It makes a lot of sense from the point of view of a patient, because the patient is saying, oh, this dude not knows his stuff. He's using a lot of technical terms. He's kind of establishing connections that make sense, because they point the toe and they say that but the gastrocnemius is making this toe, making this. Okay, make a heel raise. Oh, do you feel that? Okay, that's the muscle fiber causing, because the muscle fiber is not properly aligned. So I need to make this treatment to align it again. If you think about it, the pain that you have in your right shoulder may be due to a fascial connection that goes from C1 to, like, and you kind of make this amount of premises. That you say, okay, premise one leads to premise two, then to premise three. Therefore, the conclusion is this one. And it sounds very plausible, but it's like, okay, the body is not that stupid. And we are seeing that a lot in the fitness and nutrition spaces when it comes to, for example, how much protein I need per day, or can I eat all my calories in one sitting, or something like that. Before we were like, oh no, because you need to do it six times and you need to space it 2.5 hours, and there's anabolic window that you need to exploit, because the next half an hour after training, the body is really open to that. Nowadays, everything is simplifying. Like, no, bro, If you give your body all the calories and proteins in one sitting, you have 95% of the total thing. And we can keep going like that, and the same happens for the rehab space.
It gives that certainty, I think, as well. Like, thinking of all the benefits and the reasons why it's so appealing, it provides answers. There is like a, it's like it's a clear solution. So then to have it questioned can be tough to initially hear. And also, I want to highlight, and you've mentioned in the post, like you're not saying that anatomy is useless. It's still important for us to learn. It's more maybe the explanations that we have about some of the causality with our narratives within anatomy. You're not saying discard all of anatomy.
Of course not. Like, I believe that the thing is, anatomy has been taking the seat of the king in our realm, because if you ask everyone how important is anatomy, people will say yes. But of course there are shades of gray, and depending on the different settings that you are working with. For example, I always say that if in your country you're allowed to diagnose pathologies, many countries don't allow their physical therapists to diagnose pathologies. They need to wait until a general a physician diagnose them. If you have that ability, of course you need to know much more anatomy, because you are the one making the diagnostic labels. You're the one creating or exploring what may be happening to that person. If you are treating patients with chronic pain, for example, you may not have that need compared to someone working in acute sport injuries, for example. Like, I'm not saying that it's not important. I'm just saying that it may be more or less important depending on your circumstances, your setting, your country, your role, and your scope as a practitioner. There are many things involved to think how important, or how not useless, but the utility
Yeah,
of
the
anatomy.
relevance
Yes, of
and how
course.
it would influence the treatment of the kind of patients, the clients that you see. Where and I hope if any surgeons are listening, they're not getting too offended because fucking you need anatomy for surgery or like orthopedic kind of acute traumatic context. There is that value.
But even for surgeons, if we think about it, the anatomical possibilism also presents. For example, Jared Powell has criticized a lot the idea of subacromial impingement, and how Charles Sneer created that term in, I think it was 1972, based on a lot of anatomical assumptions that nowadays we have kind of debunked by comparing the subacromial decompression and the following bursectomy compared with a placebo surgery. And we have seen, okay, it seems that just opening the place, the joint, provides the same benefits as extracting and cutting and all these kind of surgical techniques. That cost a lot and have, of course, a lot of possible issues.
Yep, great point. I almost like skip that part, but yes, the context, the kind of patients that you're seeing, and maybe it can then recontextualize. We can reframe anatomy. I think, like you said, it's taking it's of the highest importance in general, and it might even question the role that we have. I think we see ourselves as the specialists, the professionals of the body. We know everything about the body. And so we pride ourselves in our anatomical knowledge and language that we use as a form of kind of keeping our power in a way. What would then if you were to reframe the use, the value of anatomy, what would you say within the context of maybe our role as clinicians, as physical therapists?
I would say that you can learn all the anatomy that you want, and it's fine. Of course, as everything, it has diminishing returns, and there will be things or structures that are not going to add anything beyond your personal satisfaction if you are satisfied at those things. But you need to follow that anatomical study with movement optimism. You need to Kind of, if anatomy is the name, the surname needs to be optimism, needs to be skepticism, needs to be scientific research, because I'm sure that if I now bring a class of physical therapy students or exercise physiologists, I don't mind, and show them some of the best athletes on planet Earth, showing, for example, let's imagine a pitcher, a baseball pitcher, making an absurd amount of external rotation, they may say, oh no, but that's wrong because the anatomical structures are not ready for it. Or we tell them that, for example, Usain Bolt has a leg length discrepancy, or that he has a scoliosis, and they will see the cup angle of the scoliosis and say, oh no, but that person, I'm sure that has a lot of issues exercising and all of that. So yeah, anatomy is important, but you need to have this kind of not common sense, but a logical structure to build, to use as the foundation of that anatomy.
Yeah, great points. It's like the kind of circles back to our philosophy underlying our knowledge. If we have that that positive kind of look on how adaptable, resilient our bodies can be, then it makes a huge difference compared to the kind of fragile, I guess, nature that we can keep ourselves in, or the kind of body as machine narratives for pain. I think we can get stuck in that route. So yeah, I'm thinking now, pivoting back to the beast, the chaos machine of social media. Starting with the biggest challenges within Instagram. The one that comes to my mind is how to communicate kind of evidence-based, evidence-informed posts and claims whilst capturing people's attention and not boring the shit out of them.
Yes. I admit I'm not good with that, even if I have what some people may consider a good following, but I believe that the effort that I'm investing, it's still not being matched by the attention that I'm receiving. And I'm saying this with a lot of humility. I'm not saying that I should be famous or anything. What I'm saying is that there are certain techniques that may make you more catchy for the audiences. But for example, I write. That's the first, not problem. It's not a problem, but it's neither an opportunity, because nowadays Instagram is favoring a lot of reels, so video content. You need to do something in the first second to catch the attention of the audience. So some people, what they make is like they start shouting to the camera during the first second, so people is like creating some emotions. But I believe that when I write, I'm able to express my ideas with a proper amount of correctness. So I can be correct, but I can also make things more easy to digest. So that's in part due to the graphics that I may make. But again, social media nowadays is turning into a more of a catchy platform where you have a short attention span, and you need to do everything possible, including some things that I consider unethical, to grab the attention of the listener or the audience, or the watcher. And I'm trying to make things in social media in a way that don't give me any regrets. So I don't regret posting the things that I post. But then it's true that I look at the landscape, social media landscape, and I say, okay, the most famous people is usually the people that is transmitting the most harmful or wrong information. You have accounts telling people to drink their urine to cure their cancer and to not follow the established medical pathways. And that people has a million followers. They are living in Thailand because they bought a home, and they are enjoying a great, great life. Meanwhile, there are biologists or physicians trying to transmit how incorrect that is. And people is insulting them, saying that they don't want to spread the truth, that they know that no, cancer was cured a while ago, but the creator of the cure was killed by Big Pharma because they want to make us sick so that we can keep buying the remedies and all the stuff. And it becomes a bit boring and also a bit sad when we see that landscape. But it's true that we don't have any other playing field. We need to deal with that in the ways that we consider. And hey, if we can make an impact, even if it's a small one, we should keep doing it, because that's the thing. I don't remember who said that, but the idea that the bad people will always make noise, and the good people needs to raise their own voice, because if they remain in silence, the bad people will keep advancing and establishing their headquarters, their sources of power, and they will keep spreading that evil or wrong information or whatever bad thing you want to imagine.
Yeah, bringing up kind of rebellious feelings in me just hearing you say that, I think there's a form of resistance. Yes, the kind of the uprising of the good knowledge. I think that there's a kind of ethical moral duty, perhaps with clinicians, with healthcare professionals, if we can spread and disseminate and make that knowledge accessible. And social media is just one of the places where there are people. And I think maybe acknowledging the what's out of our control with the algorithm and how the platforms generally want us to keep our attentions there. And if we acknowledge that's the way that the system is set up, we can use bits of it to still maybe ethically get people to click, ethically get people to look and spend some time with our content. So there may be some ways to be creative within the kind of, I was going to say, the shit show
I believe
that is social media.
Nowadays, we have some good examples of this. For example, Aaron Kubal, he's doing a fantastic job. He's doing a fantastic job because he's able to catch the attention of the general public. He's able to transmit in a short amount of time good information. He's also he's doing the things that the quote unquote bad people is doing, but he's kind of reframing all the apparatus to make it serve his purpose. And that purpose is, of course, in part transmitting really good and accurate information that can help people even in the absence of any treatment. And he said a while ago, many times I'm doing this, but I'm not kind of promoting my clinic or anything like that. I'm just spreading this information because I believe that it's the good thing, the fair thing to do.
Yep. The kind of ways of really spreading and promoting that information for the good of the public, and acknowledging that it can be its effort, and it might not kind of come back to us with high ROI and lots of repeat bookings and such, but it's going to be super effective in many different ways that we might not be able to see ourselves. With regards to some of the things that you've come across over the years that you've been on Instagram, what would you say from a bird's eye perspective that clinicians should maybe spend more time with, engage more with, talk more about some of the maybe underlying important issues that aren't given as much of a spotlight?
Well, there are many topics, but I've realized that when I talk about the problem of too many colleges offering, for example, new PT programs, and how the market may be saturated, while at the same time, there's a massive kind of exodus. So I have I made a post about this, I think 1 or 2 years ago, probably in August of 2023 or so. I talk about how some colleges are selling the future of the profession to enjoy the present, because we saw the same with pharmacy as a degree. Like, you saw the idea that the field is great, people is making a lot of money, they are living the best life they could, and so people, of course, outside people is attracted to the field, but you keep flooding the market. the conditions keep diminishing because you don't have any force to negotiate with the big owners, the mills, that PT mills that we call. And I believe that that's going to cause a lot of issues in the future. It's causing some issues now. And I remember one person said a while ago, okay, but I'm sure that the problem is not going to solve if we stop allowing these new faculties to offer a new physical therapeutic programs. And I said, okay, look, I don't remember. I think that it was 10,000 physical therapists left the physical therapy job in the United States in the year 2021. And that was like 10% of the total physical therapy field. And I thought, if the conditions to remain are so bad that people need to leave, of course, if you keep promoting the will of new practitioners, there will be people that will be open to burnout in 2 or 3 years and they leave. But we need to make a field that is comfortable to everyone to remain. Where are the old physical therapies? I asked it a while ago. Where are they? Because I realized that in my clinical rotations, I was usually the oldest physical therapist and I was a student. And I was like, okay, I'm 25 at the moment. The physical therapists that are teaching me are 22 or 23. Where are they all physical therapists? Because sure, some are teaching, but I know for a fact that there are no enough job vacancies available to be filled by people to work as teachers. Apart from that, there's a lot, of course, our need to implicate more in political issues. Like I talk about climate change. But of course, there are many other things that we need to talk about. And I believe that the physical therapy field and all the including chiropractors, osteopaths, everyone is following the same trend that we are seeing with other fields. Like there's kind of a path where we are losing many perks of working, while at the same time we are working extra unpaid extra hours. We are not being able to, for example, buy a home or buy a car or have kids because, of course, they are a blessing, but they cost a lot of money too. So, and I believe that we are a generation of people that will have, at least for now it seems, will have a worse adulthood than the former generations, even when we have like more languages and have a better education. We have masters, we have PhDs, and we are kind of, I think, beholding the failure of democracy as a system, the failure of justice, of course, as a way to blindly judge people. And we are also seeing the failure of states as the organization of a territory. We are seeing the failure of these three things. And I believe that that's behind the pessimism that we are beholding within the new generations, because we don't see a clear path to follow that is going to lead us to a better future. I believe that globalization has had really cool things, but we are seeing how the civil laws are being substituted or replaced by the loss of the market. Our rights more and more are resembling the rights of a consumer. We are seen more as, as a consumer, as buyers, than as people. And that's because, let's say, this is going to sound to communists, but I believe that it's a fair statement to make, that there are big companies that thrive because we buy their products and they don't want to lose their market share. At the same time, not only they want to sell products, but they want to make as much as much profit as they can. And one of the margins that they can cut is our salaries, for example, our wages, the housing crisis. Things cost much more, but our salaries remain stuck or even are diminishing. We are seeing in the United States, for example, reimbursement is diminishing. So it's you keep making less and less by doing the same. It's not that inflation is making things look worse. Is that inflation, even if there was no inflation, reimbursement would keep paying less and less to physical therapists while they keep making record profits. So it's not that they don't have money, because I will understand if they were a small company and say, look, I have 3 employees, I am not making money and I can't pay more, I can't pay you more. But the thing is that that's the situation of many clinics, for example. They can't pay you more because they are not making barely any money. But in the case of these really big companies, and you see all of them in the news. I used to write about them as a journalist because I was a specialist in economy. They keep making record profits and more record profits year after year, while the situation of their workers, the quality of life, keep diminishing. And that's, I believe, the elephant in the room that no one within our field wants to talk about. And that post that I made is, I think, the one that has had far less engagement ever. Like, you could have the previous post, like 100 comments and 1,000 likes. And that one has like 10 comments and 100 likes. And I was like, okay, I'm seeing that a lot of people is seeing this, but there's not any noise. No one is making any noise. It's like, yeah, whatever. And that's another issue, because when people is too burned out to pay attention to these things, because we need to have philosophers, for example, many philosophers had a lot of free time. And that free time is what allowed them to think. We need to have free time to not do anything, and during those times we need to think about our life and think, where are we going, where we really going, when want to go, what do we want to achieve, what, not legacy, but what do we want to make with our life. And one of those issues, of course, is what's happening with the field as a whole, what's happening with society as a whole. How is our society changing? Because I'm embedded within this society. And if this society fails, I will fail with them. I can't live outside of this society. I'm a political animal and I need to live in social circles. I'm seeing how my social circles are having the same. And this has happened to me. My social circles are in really different job occupations, but they are having conversations that are the same ones that I'm having with other physical therapists. And they don't have anything to do, but we are suffering the same issues. So these issues are not local. These are systemic. And not only they are systemic, but they are global, because the housing crisis is not only a thing in Europe. It's a thing in the United States, in Australia, in many countries that don't have anything to do. I mean, Australia is the antipodes of Spain, and we are having the exact same issues. I'm following people, I think his name is Jack Tuhi or something like that, that he's sharing about many of the issues within Australia. And I see many of them, and I think, okay, if you change Australia with Spain, the same situation is the exact same situation, the same modus operandi, everything is the years. We share the same years, and those years are going in the same direction, regardless of our circumstances. We are all in this thing.
Yeah, the geopolitical turn of this podcast is amazing. I think we need to talk about these issues a lot more and have even just open discussions. I don't think we have the opportunities or the spaces or the times. And I think on social media, it can be very hard to get people's attention to start talking about anything political. If you find that post, please let me know. I'll add that post into the show notes. Then I'm wondering, like, if we are going to spend time talking about the bigger issues, the kind of societal, sociological, political, economic, like big social determinants of healthcare, what would we need to do less of to make the space for it? You mentioned like philosophers had a lot of free time. I'm just thinking, what can maybe distract us? What would we maybe need to talk about less? It's a tough question, but open-ended.
I mean, I think that, for example, Aristotle has this theory that, okay, recreation for the sake of recreation, like going to a party or having some beers or watching the NFL or the NBA is fine, but there are things that look more like a job. They are not as comfortable as recreation, but they are the things that give us meaning. And I always say that what defines me as a person is what I do with my free time when no one is forcing me to do things. So for example, if I choose to go to the gym, that says a lot, much more about me that when I'm working. I'm not going to lie, I'm totally fine with working as a physical therapist, but what defines me as a person, if I was the last person on earth, I would be deadlifting, I would be reading, I would be listening to my music. Those are the things that I choose to do in my free time that defines me the most as a person, and I try to expand on those things as much as possible. And the cool thing is that being exposed to those Aristotle called this leisure. Well, he had, of course, he gave a Greek name, but I don't know. Let's translate it as leisure. He said, look, these things take time. You will have a lot of uncomfortable moments, but they will give you a lot of freedom and a lot of meaning, and you cannot escape this. We all have a date with reality. We need to deal with that at some point. We can't escape. Well, now that you say it, I'm going to criticize philosophers. Because one of the issues with philosophers that I have realized reading some of them is that they have tried to explain reality according to what other philosophers said. And many of them haven't had or refused to have that date with reality. And that most philosophies or all philosophies end up degenerating in idealism. And idealism has some really good points, but they can lead us to utopies and to utopian thoughts and to things that may not give us anything beyond the comfort of existing in our head and thinking, okay, everything will go fine. The just will win this thing, and things will change. And entertaining those thoughts may prevent us from taking real action. I always say that I think it was Immanuel Kant. He never left his village, but he was telling us, all of us, how to live, for example. And I'm not criticizing him, but what I'm saying is that we need to reconcile philosophy, the world of ideas, with reality, because our ideas need to shape reality. But to shape reality, we need to live that realm of ideas, of imagination, and I spend more time thinking, okay, how can I translate this to reality? And of course, another one of the issues is that people is so exhausted of their work that when they reach home, I had a friend that told me, look, I finished my job, I go to bed, and I spend like 2 hours like doing nothing, looking at the roof, because I'm so exhausted that I cannot think something that is interesting or important. I'm trying to distract myself from my situation. And when I reach the weekend, I'm trying to do everything I can to forget about my situation. But when Monday starts again, I'm living the same nightmare. And I believe that that's the big issue. And if I'm honest, I'm working now at a place that I'm really happy with. But I left 3 jobs in the matter of 6 months because I wasn't happy. I wasn't happy there. I didn't feel realized. I was with people that was not sharing my thoughts at all. Some were making things for profit, and it was they were kind of promoting marketing techniques that I'm against. I consider unethical, and I said, okay, I reached my home and I regret working here. So that's another one of the things. I understand that we all need to pay the bills, but sometimes changing our job may open the opportunity to meet great people, to work in a better environment, or even to create our own thing. I'm not saying that people should start right away and right off the bat and create their own clinic, but it's a possibility. Sometimes if you can find in your local area what you want, you need to create it. You need to become the first one. But again, you can spend time in wishful thinking like, oh no, but there's a place. I'm sure that there's a place and I will find it. And it's close to me, like 5-10 minutes from home, and they will pay more and all that. Like, maybe that place doesn't exist and you are living in your ideas. So I believe that going back to your question, because I'm being kind of thinking of that, we can sacrifice certain things that are not giving us much in terms of meaning and invest that time. For example, when I'm driving my car, I'm listening to podcasts or thinking. Maybe I don't have any volume, but because I'm doing the same, I'm going to the same place and returning to my home. I know that I know those roads as the palm of my hand, so I can spend more time thinking. And that thinking sometimes has given me a lot of value. Maybe I'm driving in my car and suddenly I reach an idea and I think, oh, that's a really good idea. And thanks to me spending this time instead of listening to music, spending this time thinking has given me a lot of value. But usually what I have tried to cut is entertainment for the sake of entertainment, in the sense of TV. I don't watch any TV. I am reading, listening, I'm training a lot nowadays. But I'm not spending much time doing those activities of watching TV. I'm not watching any of those throw 10 young adults on an island nudes and let's see what happens and all that. I don't have time for that because I don't even have time for the things that I want to do. So I need to have my priorities, and those priorities are creating new ideas and trying to find the best way to live, because that's the thing. The ultimate answer that philosophy needs to explain or try to answer is, what is a good life? How we can live a good life that is worthwhile to be lived?
Yeah. Wow, there's so many different avenues that people can listen to, then re-listen to in this podcast and find some points, whether that is, as you mentioned, more boundaries at work or finding a better workplace for you so you're not kind of coming home burnt the fuck out, exhausted, not able to even think or needing to kind of numb your mind with other things. I think that that might be a sign of creating your own little circle or starting to look at other avenues, other options, so you can do more meaningful work.
And things will improve. Things will improve if you try to do something about them. Because if, let's imagine that a skeptical features and account never existed, I could be much more miserable at this moment. I'm sure of it. Even when social media has these connotations of being a toxic place, I admit that I have found a lot of meaning within social media, and it has given me the energy to keep doing many things that I don't find any reward in the local scene. And I remember I have a teacher that asked me if I could talk to his students at the beginning of the year. I did it in December. And I told them about the skeptical fissure and all this journey that I told you. And I shared with them some articles, and I told them, look, I have 300 articles, more or less, in my account. You have the link. You have a peek of the study, so you can see if you like it or not. You just need to click in the link and read it. And if it's not open access, there are ways to access those papers. I have 200 podcasts, or 300, I don't know, let's say 200. I have books. I have posts where I'm digesting information for you for free. You just need to spend the time. You can have all the knowledge in the world, but if you are not open to spend the time accessing it and trying to understand it, you will not advance. And one of the students told me, but don't you believe that you are making things too easy for us? And I thought, look, if you don't spend the time reading those papers, you won't obtain any knowledge. I'm making things easier for you because that's what I will have. That's the thing that as a student, I would have been really grateful about. And trying to do what I thought. I'm trying to fill this spot or to fulfill this role so you can go farther, faster than me. So in that sense, it's something that I mean, I was very surprised by that question, because I was like, look, this is for you, but if you don't spend the time taking advantage of it, you're not going to take any from it.
Yeah, that there's so much gold in your stories, your pinned stories on your homepage. I was looking through it myself, found some incredible resources. So I think that's an untapped source, and it's free as well. It's like, you don't have to pay for it. It's there. And there's many options for finding the information. The information is out there. I think it's now, you've kind of inspired me as well to be a bit more intentional with the time that you spend on your phone, if you're using it. Mm-hmm. And it can be definitely a vehicle, a tool for opening up to educational resources. Mm-hmm. If there's time for one more question about filtering, is that okay? So how did then, I think this is linked kind of to the question of, how do you filter the overwhelming amount of content, of information on your newsfeed? Or what advice would you give? The one of the things I hear is like, oh, who should I follow? Who should I unfollow? What are your thoughts on better developing our own filters?
I think that you need to expose yourself to many different contents. Now, it's a trial and error process, because of course, as I told you, the things that I started with are not the things that I'm doing nowadays, and the people that I'm following today don't have anything to do with the people that I started following. We start as naive students, and we keep growing, but you need to expose yourself to a lot of information, not only about the field, but about outside the field. I recommend people a lot to read this book. It's by Steven Novella. He's the owner of the science-based medicine page. It's called Skeptical Guide.
The Skeptic's Guide to the
Skeptic Guide
Universe or the Future?
The Universe, yes.
The Universe,
yeah. The Universe, yes. And that's a great example of meta-thinking, like, how should we think? How do we differentiate between what's important or not? Of course, I could say no, because they are evidence-based, they are sharing papers, but that's not the end of it, because evidence can be used for whatever purposes. We have seen it with anatomy, and it's a much empirical proven field of knowledge than the papers that many people are sharing. And of course, we are all wrong. And I congratulate myself to say that I'm wrong, and I don't have any problem, because I'm aware of my limitations as a person, and it's totally fine to change your opinions. That's an important thing that you need to take in mind. If people is never changing their opinion, never admitting that they were wrong, they may not be the best people to follow. Or maybe they are still in that growing phase where they can't admit their mistake. But I think that at some point, it's really clear that some people have an ideological agenda. They are pushing it. And even if they are exposed to content that, or things that are proven, then otherwise, they are not open to live or to advance their thinkings.
Yep,
that's
so
one example.
Looking at people who change, to update, who kind of are humble enough to change what they say, or what, given the totality of evidence, rather than kind of being so stubborn and stuck in their ways, as if they haven't kind of changed anything that they said for years, but scientific consensus or growing amount of evidence has said otherwise, then that's a sign.
And at the same time, you should check the hidden interest that they may have. So, for example, if I tell you that all vegetables are wrong, and it's a coincidence, but I have a company that only sells meat, and it's also a coincidence, but in each of my posts I'm promoting that same company, and it's also a coincidence, but I'm not telling you that I'm the owner. There are certain conflicts of interest. I mean, there's nothing wrong with using social media as a marketing tool, but there's people that what they are doing is, they are changing the truth. They are eliminating the truth. They are repeating lies to the extent that they become the new truthful statements. And when they establish those points, they say, okay, now it's time to sell, to make profit out of it. But sometimes, I mean, in our field, we change a lot our opinions. We need to have that in mind, but sometimes I go back to the same point, but if people is trying to sell you everything all the time, and I think that you have those, you as a person are open to see that, like, okay, this person is too pushy with this. They are always trying to sell me something, and all their information is meant to sell me something. That's another red flag that I will have in mind.
Yeah. Yeah. If you feel the kind of salesman vibes, I think that's a sign if that it's just about their products or they're not disclosing or being transparent about conflicts of interest. I think there are people with conflicts of interest, absolutely, but there's a difference between kind of hiding it, as you said, or being open and honest about it.
And you can find it. I remember the magnetic tape issue. I don't know if you know about it.
Magnetic tape.
Yeah, a paper that was published on MDPI, that it was about a magnetic tape. So that caused a lot of noise because it was published from a research group in my country. But I remember Chris Maher talking about it because it was magnetic tape for low back pain. And if I remember that the primary author was the owner of the magnetic tape. But if you go nowadays, you will find the same. If you go to the conflicts of interest, you will find that there were no conflicts of interest attached. For example, that's one easy way. But I have found that same formula repeated over and over and over again on papers trying to show that a method or a product works.
Far out. Yeah, that the direct effect of magnetic tape on pain and lower extremity blood flow in subjects with low back pain. I'll link that one as well.
Yes.
Far out. Diego, this has been an absolute amazing blockbuster episode. I've really valued your time. And if you didn't have, you know, a life to get to after this, we'd be talking for hours. But for the listeners who don't know who you are, where can we follow you, find your work?
Well, you can find me usually. Well, I have two social media accounts. I have one on Instagram that is Skeptical Physio. I have one on Twitter that is Physio Skeptical. It's just the other way, reasoning the other way. But I'm mostly active on Instagram because honestly, it takes a lot of time to maintain social media. It's a part-time job, at least. And sometimes, depending on the days, it becomes kind of a full-time job. If you have because your Instagram shows you the amount of hours that you invest on social media on your account, sometimes it's closer to a full-time job. So I don't have time for any other social media accounts. So yeah, you can find me in those two ways. And it's been a pleasure today to be here with you, Daniel.
Legend, thank you. I'll link that as well. Mate, keep up the amazing work. And yeah, until the next time.
Thank you, Daniel. Thank you a lot.